Good evening, Los Angeles, and welcome to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. I am Nicholas Miller, here with my most erudite of co-hosts, Steve Cato. Why don't you say hi to everyone, wow. Steve Cato?
Well, that's awfully nice of you to say, Nicholas. Hi, everyone. I'm Steve Cato. How are you all doing? Out there in Radio Land.
Yeah. This is now week two of what Steve has dubbed
Wally Weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve, how long do you think we can keep up Wally Weeks?
I don't know. I think we can probably do at least one more week of Wally Weeks. I think, obviously we're inspired by Shark Week, right? That's what we're inspired by here.
Yeah, that's right. Well, as the holiday season is approaching, it's getting colder, you'll be out shopping, running into people, maybe touching handrails that people who are ill have been touching, and you yourself may get ill. So we thought that this week we would focus on a talker who's going to talk a little bit about illness. He's not going to talk about the same kind of illness you'd get from said handrail, but he is going to talk about a different kind of illness. I'd even call it an ideological illness. Wouldn't you say so, Steve?
Yeah, and, you know, just to prove a point, I suppose, and to second the wisdom of you bringing up dirty handrails, the holiday season, it's colder and damper than it is for much of the rest of the year in Los Angeles right now. Don't be foolish, folks. Wash your hands carefully. Don't get sick. I'm saying this because I've had a flu all week and it's been terrible. I can't wait for it to be over. You can hear even my voice being, you know, not its normal gong-like quality. It's now some sort of shadow of itself. So please be careful out there this holiday season. Having covered that, the hand washing, etc. Yes, our guest has something, a sickness of a totally different nature to talk about. Maybe more rightly said, like an economic sickness almost, or a social economic sickness, maybe. Not so much the flu.
Right. It's almost inconceivable that you'd catch some kind of illness, but I can speak from my own experience that I've had the exact same illness as our host tonight. And it's a very difficult thing to deal with. I feel like I'm still grappling with it and I don't really know what to do. But I can say that when our host was telling us a little bit about his way of dealing with it, it helped me. It did. It very much helped.
I think you mean guest, not host.
Wouldn't you say, Steve?
We're the hosts. But yeah, I agree. I think our guest has done some really amazing work in the past, and I can't wait to hear what he's got to say tonight. I'm just thrilled.
Right. Well, here we have it, folks. The one and only Wallace Shawn.
And I wake up suddenly in the silence before dawn in a strange hotel room in a poor country where my language isn't spoken. And I'm shaking and shivering. Why? There's something is happening far away in a different country. Oh, yes, I remember. It's the execution. The newspaper article said this would be the hour, this was the date. I catch my breath, and so now they come. They come for the man who lies on his cot, the cat-like man whose face is so large, so black, that the guards who open his cell are once again frightened, shaken. They shave his head, a section of his leg, so the electrodes will fit closely on the skin. And now the guards lead him into the chamber, and he's tied into the chair with leather straps. His arms are strapped down to armrests so the witnesses won't see them move. his legs strapped to the legs of a chair. Does panic mount in the man's heart? An attendant covers his head with a hood so none of us will see his pain, the horror, the distortion of his face, the breaking of the skin. All we see is the body shifting upwards slightly in the chair. Don't you think, when you're traveling in a strange country, that the smells are sharp and upsetting? And when you wake up in the middle of the night unexpectedly, when you wake up at an odd hour, when you're traveling somewhere and you wake up in a strange place, don't you feel frightened? I can't stop shivering. The lamp by my bed doesn't work. The electric lights won't turn on. The rebels have blown up the electricity towers. There's a small war going on in this poor country where my language isn't spoken. The hotel rooms all have candles with little candle holders. I get up, light the candle, take the candle into the bathroom, then I put the candle and its holder on the floor, and I kneel down in front of the toilet and vomit. Then I'm sitting, shivering on the bathroom floor. This cold square of tile on a hot night in a hot country, and I can't stand up to go back to bed. I can't stand up, so I sit there quietly, shaking as if I were sitting in the snow. And in the corner of the bathroom, brown against the tile, there's an insect, big like a water bug. It's flat, heavy, very tough legs. They look like metal. And it's waiting, squatting, deciding which way to move. And in a second, it's crossed behind the sink, and it's slipping itself into a hole too small for it to fit in. But it fits in. It fits. It's gone. And I see myself. I see myself, a moment of insight. It's the birthday party in the fancy restaurant. Yes. There is the table with its sweet and pretty decorations, the fanciful centerpiece, pink and green. And there are all the women in bright red lipstick and the men in beautiful shirts and all the gifts, outrageous, unexpected, and funny gifts. And there are the waiters serving the salmon and pouring the wine, and there I am. I'm talking quietly with that small, pale woman in the red and blue dress about the love affair with the older man, that film that disturbed her, the actress, the psychiatrist, the criminals, the walks at night through the woods in the country, the insatiable appetite for violent sex, the suffering of the people who live in desperation in the crowded shelter across the street from the fancy restaurant. And as I talked with that woman in the red and blue dress, I thought I was a person who was thinking about a party, who had so many complicated feelings about it, who liked some aspects of the party, but not others, who liked some of the people, but not all of them, who liked the pink and green centerpiece, but didn't really like that red and blue dress. But no. No, I see it so clearly. I see myself with my little fork. I wasn't a person who was thinking about a party. I was a person who was at a party, who sat at the table, drank the wine, and ate the fish. We didn't talk about the fish. We didn't talk about the restaurant. We talked about the lakes in the mountains in the north of Thailand and the crowded shelter across the street. But where were we? Where were we? We not by the lakes, not in the shelter. We were there, just there at that table in that restaurant. Well, Maybe for certain people who lived at the beginning of the 20th century, what was hidden and unconscious was the inner life. Maybe the only thing that those people could see was the outward circumstance. where they were, what they did. They had no idea at all of what was inside them. But something's been hidden from me, too. Something, a part of myself, has been hidden from me. And I think it's the part that's there on the surface. What anyone in the world could see about me if they saw me out the window of a passing train. Because I know quite a bit about what's inside me. I've been a student of my feelings since I was 9 years old. My feelings, my thoughts. The incredible history of my feelings and my thoughts could fill up a dozen leather-bound books. But the story of my life, my behavior, my actions, now that's a slim volume, and I've never read it. Well, I've never wanted to. I've always thought it would be terribly boring. What would be in it? Chapter 1, my childhood. I was born. I cried. Chapter 2, the rest. I maintained myself. I got up. I went to work. I went home. I went to bed. I went to a restaurant and I ate fish. Who cares? For God's sake, did I have to travel to a poor country where no books are printed in my own language? Did I have to be cast down onto a bathroom floor in a strange hotel in order to finally be forced to open that dull volume, the story of my life? And I vomit again. Dear God. No, I'm not going to read it. I won't read it. My parents loved me. They raised me to think about people, the world, humanity, beauty. Not to think about restaurants and fish. I was born into the mind, lamplight, the warm living room, my father in an armchair reading about China, my mother with the newspaper on a long sofa, orange juice on a table in a glass pitcher. And they read me a book about all the people in so many different uniforms who came to our house to help our family. Coming from every corner of our beautiful city, the delivery man from the grocery store, the mailman with the mail, all so kind. And down the street, the old woman who worked in the bakery, who bent down and gave me sugar-covered buns. And dear God, I never doubted that life was precious. I've always thought life should be celebrated. Today, I went to an office, a quiet office, a few cabinets and chairs, and its job was to make a record of all the cases of political murder and torture and rape. Rape used as a form of torture or in the course of torture. The man showed me photographs on the walls of the bleeding corpses of his friends. The blood was bright red. One was a school teacher killed near her school. And there were black and white snapshots of shyly smiling women and men at some time before their deaths. And these were pinned up next to the pictures of their corpses, the faces radiant with goodness. And I thought of the delicacy with which my parents had taught me to urinate into the toilet, to be careful around toilet seats, to wash my hands always with soap, to avoid people with the flu, with colds, to avoid drafts, to avoid rooms that were cold or wet. And I thought of how they taught me to love traveling, the wonderful train trips, the magic of riding at night through the farmland in our little compartment, brushing our teeth on the moving train. And here, from my spot on the bathroom floor, I can see through the window, gorgeous in the moonlight, the gorgeous mountains of the poor country, soaked with the blood of the innocent, soaked with the blood of those shy faces, battered shy faces, walking through a garden with my mother, enormous roses, and through a dark pine forest, my father pointing to a yellow bird, save me. You see, I like Beethoven. I like to hear the bow of the violin cut into the string. I like to follow the phrase of the violin as it goes on and on like a deep-rooted orgasm squeezed out into a rope of sound. I like to go out at night in a cosmopolitan city and sit in a dark auditorium watching dancers fly into each other's arms. Yes, suppose that certain people whose hearts admittedly are filled with love, are being awakened suddenly at night by groups of armed men. Suppose that they are being dragged into a stinking van with a carpet on the floor and stomped by boots till their lips are swollen like oranges, streaming with blood. Yes, I was alive when those things were done. I lived in the town whose streets ran with the blood of good-hearted victims. I wore the clothes which were pulled from the bodies of the victims when they were raped and killed. But I love the violin. I love the music, the dancers, everything I touch, everything I see, the city with its lights, the theaters, coffee shops, newsstands, books, the constant celebration. Life should be celebrated. Life is a gift. And I can't stand the way people say, when I was a child, I loved elephants. When I was a child, I loved balloons. Are they trying to say that if they stopped and looked at a balloon today or at an elephant today, they would not love them? Why wouldn't they love them? I think we still love what we always loved. How could we not? And one of the things that I always loved, I wonder if you did, was the wonderful way that valuable small objects, the Christmas presents and birthday presents that adults always gave to each other, were wrapped, were packed. Say the present was a small china cup or a saucer or a tiny china vase. Well, first, there'd be a brown cardboard box from the shop that looked like it ought to have a rocking horse or a tricycle inside because it was just so big. Except that if you lifted it, it was always incredibly, miraculously light. And you would always imagine that that big brown box had been packed up and sealed up by some sort of huge and muscly industrial workers who were completely indifferent to the contents of the box. And then someone would make a cut with a knife in the brown tape at the top of the box. And when they pulled the two halves of the top apart, there would always be a huge sort of industrial snapping sound. And then inside that big cardboard box, you'd find another box wrapped in thick, shiny paper and tied with some brightly colored, thick, shiny ribbon, which wasn't really needed to keep the box closed. And you would naturally imagine that this inside box had been wrapped by some very refined and modest-looking lady whose hands were softened with sweet-smelling cream and who very definitely cared a great deal about whatever it was that was inside the box. And then when the paper and the ribbon were undone and removed and the box itself, with its smooth surface like clear milk, was finally revealed, someone would take off the top of the box. And you would hear at that moment a little rustling or nestling sound, like the sound of a hamster moving in its cage. And that would be the sound of all the tiny little pieces of squunched up paper that filled the box, giving a sort of quiet little sigh as the taking off of the top of the box gave them some sudden extra breathing space. And then the most exciting part of the opening would start, which was the attempt to find out what in particular was inside the box, aside from all the pieces of squenched up paper, if in fact there was anything else inside there at all, because at first you always thought, well, really, this time, there is nothing else. So then someone, maybe you, would plunge their hand down deep into the box, as if they were a diver searching for a pearl, and eventually they would come upon something hard, something tightly wrapped in a different sort of paper. And when that last bit of wrapping was finally undone, there would be the cup or saucer or tiny little vase just suitable for one little flower. And maybe if you'd seen that cup or saucer or vase just sitting on a shelf in a shop somewhere, you might have thought it was nothing in particular. Or maybe if you'd seen it lying in a pile with heaps of others like it in the corner of some dark, dusty place that sold odds and ends, you would have thought it was an old piece of junk. But by the time it had been pulled out of all that paper, out of that milk-white box, out of that cardboard carton, it seemed like the most shining, sparkling thing in the world. And how delicate it seemed. How breakable and precious. And you were right, it was. And my friends and I were the delicate, precious, breakable children. And we always knew it. We knew it because of the way we were wrapped, because of the soft underwear laid out on our beds, soft socks to protect our feet. And I remember that my darling mother, my beautiful mother, my innocent mother, would say to me and my friends when we were 9 or 10, "Now be very careful. Don't go near First Avenue. That's a bad neighborhood. There are tough kids there." And we had no idea what that meant. She had no idea. We thought that certain kids were tough. Maybe they just liked to be. And they lived in certain neighborhoods. Maybe because their friends were there. Nice people had gathered in our neighborhood, had formed a community, and it was a good neighborhood. On First Avenue and other avenues, there were bad neighborhoods where tough people had gathered together. And those were the neighborhoods we had to avoid. We still avoid them all, my friends. Bad neighborhoods. The people who live in places like that would hurt you, beat you, cut you, kill you. All the ones who would hurt you collect in those neighborhoods like water in drains. And it's terrible. It's awful. Why should people want to hurt each other? I always say to my friends, we should be glad to be alive. We should celebrate life. We should understand that life is wonderful. Shouldn't we decorate our lives and our world as if we were having a permanent party? Shouldn't there be bells made of paper hanging from the ceiling and paper balls and white and yellow streamers? Shouldn't people dance and hold each other close? Shouldn't we fill the tables with cake and presents? Yes, but we can't have celebrations in the very same room where groups of people are being tortured or groups of people are being killed. We have to know where are we and where are the ones who are being tortured and killed, not in the same room. No, but surely, isn't there any other room we can use? Yes, but we still could hear the people screaming. Well, then, can't we use the building across the street? Well, maybe. But wouldn't it feel strange to walk by the window during our celebrations and look across at the building we're in now and think about the blood and the deaths and the testicles being crushed inside it? Who are the ones who are being tortured and killed? It was explained to me, the followers of Marx. The dizziness drops my head to the floor. I feel as if a rope that's been wrapped around my temples is being tightened and released, and there's an aching pain in the center of my stomach. In my own country, I've always loved staying in hotels. In fact, one of the things I think I like best is to sleep in a hotel in some new city and then to get up early while the birds are singing and call room service and get them to send me up a big pot of coffee and then to lie in bed and call my friends on the telephone while I sip my coffee. I can spend literally hours like that, just talking on the telephone and laughing and drinking more coffee and watching the sun coming in the window and moving around the room, and then I get up and go about my day. But staying in a hotel in a foreign country is always different. I'll tell you about a funny incident that happened at lunch today. Well, it was my own reaction that was funny, really. The hotel had a banquet Everyone had huge plates of food, pork, shrimp, lobster, game. I stood outside, and there was a girl of maybe 16 who sat on some steps not far from me. She was a peasant girl, barefoot, her legs peeping out from a faded skirt. Her eyes were blurred as if she'd been whipped. She was waiting for something. Carved into the corner of the stone steps in an attitude of incredible gravity and grace. Suddenly, a young man with a foolish expression came out of the hotel dressed in a suit. He was heading toward the girl on the steps, and from the way he waved at her, I realized she must have been one of his family's maids. He was holding out to her a tiny little plate with a few beans on it. That was her lunch. Well, she smiled to acknowledge that gift of food. And I had an immediate reaction. I wanted to punch that young man in the face, throw him in the bushes. It was really quite funny. What did I think I was, this week's radical gorilla? Then he went back inside, oblivious of me, of course, and the moment passed. About a year ago, I spent a day at a nude beach with a group of people I didn't know that well. Lying out there naked in the sun, there was a man who kept talking about the ruling class, the elite, the rich, all day long. The rich are pigs. They are all pigs. Someday those pigs will get what they deserve and things like that. He was a thin man with a large mustache, unhealthy looking but very handsome, a chain smoker. As he talked, he would laugh, sort of bitter barks that came out always unexpectedly. I'd heard about these words and these phrases all of my life, but I'd never met anyone who actually used them. I thought it was quite entertaining. But for about a month afterwards, a strange thing happened. Everywhere I went, I started getting into conversations with people I met, on a train, on a bus, at parties, in line for a movie. And everyone I met was talking like him. The rich are pigs. Their day will come. They're all pigs. And on and on. I started to think that maybe I was crazy. I thought I was insane. Could this really be happening? Was everyone now a communist but me? And this was all happening at the very same time that communism had finally died. And social pathologists were arguing over what had caused its death. The newspapers and magazines reported no nostalgia for the defunct system, and it seemed as if all the intellectuals and political leaders who had ever been known to have fallen under its sway were running in all directions looking for shelter. So, then who were all these people who kept grabbing hold of me? One day there was an anonymous present sitting on my doorstep, Volume 1 of Capital by Karl Marx. In a brown paper bag. A joke, serious, and who had sent it I never found out. Late that night, naked in bed, I leafed through it. The beginning was impenetrable. I couldn't understand it. But when it came to the part about the lives of the workers, the coal miners, the child laborers, I could feel myself suddenly breathing more slowly. How angry he was! Page after page. Then I turned back to an earlier section, and I came to a phrase that I'd heard before. A strange, upsetting, sort of ugly phrase. This was the section on commodity fetishism. The fetishism of commodities. I wanted to understand that weird-sounding phrase, but I could tell that to understand it, your whole life would probably have to change. His explanation was very elusive. He used the example that people say 20 yards of linen are worth £2. People say about every thing that it has a certain value. This is worth that. This coat, this sweater, this cup of coffee, each thing worth some quantity of money or some number of other things. One coat worth three sweaters or so much money, as if that coat, suddenly appearing on the earth, contained somewhere inside itself an amount of value, like an inner soul, as if the coat were a fetish, a physical object that contains a living spirit. But what really determines the value of a coat? What is it that determines the price of a coat? The coat's price comes from its history, the history of all the people who were involved in making it and selling it, and all the particular relationships they had. And if we buy the coat, we too form relationships with all of those people, and yet we hide those relationships from our own awareness by pretending we live in a world where coats have no history but just fall down from heaven with prices marked inside. I like this coat, we say. It's not expensive. As if that were a fact about the coat, and not the end of a story about all the people who made it and sold it. I like the pictures in this magazine. A naked woman leans over a fence. A man buys a magazine and stares at her picture. The destinies of these two are linked. The man has paid the woman to take off her clothes to lean over the fence. The photograph contains its history. The moment the woman unbuttoned her shirt, how she felt, what the photographer said. The price of the magazine is a code that describes the relationships between all those people, the woman, the man, the publisher, the photographer, who commanded, who obeyed. The cup of coffee contains the history of the peasants who picked the beans, how some of them fainted in the heat of the sun. Some were beaten, some were kicked. For 2 days, I could see the fetishism of commodities everywhere around me. It was a strange feeling. Then on the third day, I lost it. It was gone. I couldn't see it anymore. But not long after the gift of the book, I was waiting for a bus. Someone with a very nice smile was standing behind me, their thin chest covered by a faded T-shirt, and written on the T-shirt was a single word. It was the name of a revolutionary country. The bus was delayed. It got later and later, and I finally smiled at the smile that was standing behind me, and I asked the person, have you been to that country? The one on your shirt? And the person said, yes. Have you been there too? With a flush of warmth coming into their face. Then a bus pulled up, but the person got on, and it wasn't my bus. About 6 months later, I'd been to a party in an elegant part of town, and I'd had a lot to drink. It was a dark night. The streets were wet. I was racing along by some blue trees, and suddenly I saw a pool of light, and in the center of the light, a walnut-faced man with gray hair and a dusky suit was hailing a taxi. He'd been at the party, but we hadn't spoken. He asked me if I was going his way, and I was. His accent was musical. We got in the taxi. His hands were shaking with an odd tremor, and his voice sounded like a thick, dark syrup. He was speaking in these very condensed and ironic phrases, and after a while I awkwardly said, I can't place your accent. Where are you from? He looked at me darkly. And with particular irony, he revealed that he came from the revolutionary country whose name I'd seen on the T-shirt months before. He worked for that country as a diplomat. Is it difficult to travel to your country, I asked. He explained mildly that you could find yourself there in a matter of hours. A few months later, I went to the revolutionary country. It wasn't like the lies I'd heard about it. There were lots of soldiers. That was a fact. But to me, they looked more like shepherds in Renaissance paintings. Their green uniforms looked like pajamas. I was very refreshed. I talked to officials who got to their offices at dawn. They were all very tired, but very polite. Gentle, humorous. Some were very warm. Some seemed wistful. One day I stopped in a public square, and I wrote in my notebook the romantic sentence, "These shy smiles are like a garden for me." I stayed in an eccentric, expensive hotel, and the ice cream there seemed to me like a drug. It was so light, delicious, perfect. I couldn't get enough of this amazing ice cream. A journalist I met who was staying at the hotel explained to me that it didn't make sense to admire a revolution because of its ice cream, because it could really be considered an imperfection in the revolution that resources would be devoted to making ice cream at all when some people still didn't have enough to eat. His remark was valid, but he missed the point. The ice cream was charming. I continued my trip, and I decided to go to more poor countries. I went to poor countries whose names were written on no T-shirts, where the soldiers had strange expressions on their faces, where wealthy families sat in glittering restaurants, eating plate after plate of multicolored ice cream, but when I tasted the ice cream, every flavor tasted the same, and none were delicious. I grew weak hearing descriptions of electrical torture, the condition of bodies. I saw orchards of unsurpassed beauty where the workers had been raped and strung up from the trees. But one bright sunny Sunday, I went to a tiny church, crowded with gaunt faces, and there was joyful singing, and the priest spoke of a loving Christ, the importance of forgiveness, tolerance, mercy. And one afternoon in a dark cafe, I drank a cup of tea with an armed guerrilla, Juana, a follower of Marx. It was a little bit scary. Her skin was yellowish, her eyes too bright. She seemed to be on fire with a painful illness. Well, not really a follower of Marx, but his name seemed wonderful to her. Even his picture seemed beautiful, because unlike the other philosophers and educated people, she explained to me, Marx had made the strange gesture of throwing his life at the feet of the poor. In other words, Marx was a follower of theirs. He was on their side. I kept trying to get her to talk about herself. She hadn't seen her home for a long time. She loved her parents. She had two small children. Her husband had died in his early 20s. She spoke to me feverishly about a sister who had been killed, clenching and unclenching her hands. Her sister's head had been mutilated. After her sister's death, she'd left her village and walked into the mountains to find the rebels. She'd learned how to go without eating for days, the poise, the dignity of a wild animal. I went home and I resumed my regular life, but I couldn't help noticing that something awful was happening to me. At first I tried to ignore it or dismiss it like some symptom you hope will go away by itself, but it didn't go away. What was it that was happening? I'd always said, I'm a happy person, I love life. But now there was a sort of awful indifference or blankness. It was coming from somewhere inside me and filling me up bit by bit. Things that would once have delighted me or cheered me seemed to go dead on me. To spoil, sometimes it was as if someone was strangling me. I went to see some people I knew, close friends. I'd never visited their home before, and we'd all been looking forward to my visit for years. This is our bedroom. Opening a door. The baby sleeps here. Each room was beautiful. Each had a simple tastefulness. There were striking touches. There were lovely objects from around the world. In the children's rooms, there was blue sky wallpaper even on the ceiling. Shelves with big yellow chickens and ducks. But I felt wrong. I felt sick. I felt nothing, a numbness. I went to a play with a group of friends, a legendary actress in a great role. We stared at the stage. Moment after moment, the character's downfall crept closer. Her childhood home would at last be sold. Her beloved cherry trees chopped down. Under the bright lights, the actress showed anger, bravado. The stage rang with her youthful laughter, which expressed self-deception. She would be forced to live in an apartment in Paris, not on the estate she'd formerly owned. A man whose father had once worked there as a serf would now buy the estate. It was her old brother's sympathetic grief that finally coaxed tears from the large man in the heavy coat who sat beside me. But my problem was that somehow, suddenly I was not myself. I was disconcerted. Why exactly were we supposed to be weeping? This person would no longer own the estate she'd once owned. She would have to live in an apartment instead. I couldn't remember why I was supposed to be weeping. Riding in a taxi home from the play, my friends were critical of one of the actors. His performance had been slack, inadequate, not thought through. If the character he played in behaved in such a fashion in the first act, his later actions could not be explained. I stared frozen out the taxi window. Sometimes I was fine. I remember one morning, a marvelous blue sky, I had my hair cut. Gentle hands molded my hair so that it fit over the shape of my scalp like a cap. Then I bought myself a pair of comfortable socks, and then I looked at them carefully, and I bought two more pairs because it's not easy to find the kind of socks I like. Then I went to a sweet little restaurant and had lunch with a woman in a lemon-yellow suit whom I'd known since I was 8. But then I got into a taxi, and as I was riding across the city, that feeling, that sickness filled me up again. It seemed to start in my stomach and move out through my legs, my chest. And my stomach was beating. It was just like a heart. A cold sweat on my forehead and neck. I wasn't me. When the taxi arrived, the person who got out of it wasn't me. I was nowhere. The person who paid the driver was actually no one. Someone with whom I'd had a very happy love affair years ago was waiting to meet me. We smiled, we embraced, but I wasn't there to be embraced. The person I was hugging felt like a doll, electrically warmed. I myself was a funny-smelling doll. In the old apartment full of memories, we talked about a recent play, a film, terrible performance by a group of dancers, one of whom we knew. And I heard about the dinner with our friend Nadia, who was working on her painting but also was doing graphic design, and the story of the wooden figures smuggled out of Mexico wrapped in clothes. Our funny friend Petrus had had his wallet stolen. Amazingly, the police had caught the thief as he was running down the street. Petrus had said the man's criminal record was as long as that biography of Henry James. The Adventures of Petrus with the Police and the Courts were a hilarious comedy, Petrus being Petrus. But as I listened to the story, I remembered that a friend of my mother's had once said to me, "I like you because you have such a nice, loud, merry laugh." And I noticed that my laugh was like a tight little cough. We were going to have dinner with another friend of ours in a hotel dining room near the office where he worked. But when we met our friend, we wandered by mistake into the hotel ballroom. There were prosperous-looking executives, probably retired, dancing with their wives to awful music. Men with baggy pants and big thighs and coins in their pockets. And their wives were wearing flowery dresses with their hair like wigs, and our friend said, God, how unhappy they are. How painful it is, how sad life is. But I stared at the executives in their dark suits and felt only that numbness. It was even in my mouth, on my tongue, a sort of sour lovelessness, a sort of horrible, rotting lovelessness. And toward the end of dinner, our friend finally told us that his father had died. He described the hospital, the doctors, the machines. It was as if he felt no one had ever died before. As if he felt it was quite unfair that his father should have died. Yet, no expense had been spared to extend his father's life for as long as possible, to make sure that his death was as comfortable as possible. Hard-working experts surrounded his bed, doing all they could to see that he would die without feeling pain. I couldn't help mentioning those others who died every day on the torture table, screaming, carved up with knives, surrounded on their bed of death by other experts who were doing all they could to be sure the ones they surrounded would die in howling agony, unimaginable agony. My remarks were out of place. Where was the sympathy I owed my friend? His loss was real. He looked at me appalled. By then it was Christmas. A festive atmosphere filled the streets and shops, and one night I had a dream, and I dreamt it was Christmas, and I had a wonderful family with two or three young children, and in the dream I woke up suddenly, frightened and sweating, and I went to the bathroom to brush my teeth. My toothbrush, paste, and water glass were crowded as usual onto a shelf. As I glanced into the bathroom mirror for a moment, the shelf on which all these things rested started to tilt. My water glass slid slowly along it, then fell and broke on the tile into thick, sharp pieces. I lost my balance, slipped, and stepped directly onto a shard of glass. Blood filled the floor. My family came. I was crying, sobbing. I'm sorry, I said. I cannot give you any more presents. I love you all, but I don't want to give you any more presents. The words came flying out of my mouth. I didn't know why I was saying them. I'd always wanted my children to be happy. I'd always wanted them to have the best of everything. Then I woke up and thought about the dream, the presents. I thought about Christmas, the streets, the shops. Was that why people brought children into the world? So that they too could one day roam through the streets buying, devouring, always the best food, the best clothes, the best everything, so that they too could demand the best? Were there not enough people in the world already who demanded the best, who insisted on the best? No. We must have more of those people. We must bring in children, and then we must gather together more treasures from all over the world, more of the best, for all these new children of ours to have, because our children should have the best. It would be our shame, our disgrace to give them less than the best. We will stop at nothing to give them the best. I was in a very bad state, and it wasn't that I'd particularly loved the trip I'd just taken, but I felt that maybe I should go back again. Go back again to more poor countries, that maybe that was the thing I should do to cure my feeling of sickness or restlessness or whatever it was. I even had a suitcase that was still not unpacked, and so I thought, well, maybe. And here I am. My last night in my own country I spent in an airport hotel. The people in the room above mine were playing music much too late. I called the front desk and complained. As I lay in bed, I imagined the people above me listening. They were dressed in comfortable, informal clothes. They were free, happy, maybe a little bit drunk or high. Maybe they were dancing. I'd always been so fond of the song they were playing, a beautiful song. And I felt a sort of exquisite pleasure lying against my pillow listening to the song, waiting for the moment when the hotel detective would knock on the door of the room above mine and the music would suddenly stop in mid-phrase. I try to stand up to leave the bathroom. I get to my knees, but I can't stand up. Draped over the bathtub, there's a purple bath mat. I grab it, I pull it onto the floor, I pull it over toward me, and I slide it beneath me. Do you know, there are nights in the city where I grew up, the city I love most of all, when it's too cold for rain, but the sky can't snow yet, so although you feel it would like to. So instead, it seems that at a certain moment, every car and face and pane of glass is suddenly covered by a delicious wetness, like the wetness you see on a frozen cherry. And on nights like that, when you walk through the streets of the nice parts of town, you see all the men in overcoats that hang straight down to the ground, staring harshly with open-mouthed desire at the fox-headed women whose lipstick ripples, whose earrings ripple as they step through the uneven light and darkness of the sidewalk. And that is the sort of thing that the communists will never understand. That is the sort of thing that the communists will never understand. Just as human decency is the sort of thing that I will never understand.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Real slam dunk.
That was inconceivably good.
Inconceivable.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. The delivery, the cadence. Oh.
I mean, the coughing?
Even the content of the talking. Sometimes here on the talking show, the content is of secondary interest, but not tonight. That was a home run.
Oh.
What'd you think, Steve?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I actually really enjoyed that. That was way better than usual for us here on the talking show. I can't wait till next week's installment of Wally Week.
Yeah. Would you say that you have suffered from the same kind of illness or fever that Mr. Sean was suffering with?
Yeah. I mean, I think whether they want to admit it or not, everyone in our audience must have suffered from the same ailment. It's practically a given, I would say, as just a historical fact. Wouldn't you say so, Nick?
Yeah. No, man, I had it bad. I had it real bad. I mean, I even went in the throes of it. I went down to Skylight Books on Vermont. You know that place? You know, it's like kind of an intellectual bookstore, but I mean, let's be frank, it leaves something to desire. But I went there and I got that Balibar and Althusser book, Reading Capital, hoping that would help. And that just threw me further down the spiral. I saw exchange relationships and commodity fetish in everything. Everything, even ice cream.
Well, you know, I did that David Harvey Capital lecture series with a bunch of friends once. And that's a whole other piece of work there. That's kind of, it's frustrating in other respects. The exchange relations and commodity fetishism part is, of course, great to think about, but it's more the connectedness of that to your own social terrain, I think, that's the part that really gets me.
Yeah, well, I'm getting better. I think I'm getting better. I've lightened up, as they say.
Huh.
But I don't think it's a sort of illness that ever goes away. But we'll see. Hopefully I have a long time to explore that.
Yeah, well, speaking personally, I can't wait for my current actual very physical illness to dissipate, hopefully by next week when we continue Wally Weeks.
You listeners may have noticed that was not the complete talk.
No, it wasn't.
By Wallace Shawn.
Mm-mm.
He's going to be back next week with part two of The Fever. So have a good night, everyone.
Stay tuned. Good night.